to the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Tonight is crime night here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show, and we do this once a month, final Friday night of each month. We will have later in the program Jerry Capici, Jerry, the author of Gangland News, great website, outstanding reporter on all matters concerning the American-Italian organized crime unit or organization known as the Mafia. We'll also have Tim Reiterman, who authored the definitive history of Jim Jones called Raven, the Untold Story of Jim Jones and His People. But first and foremost, as always, we welcome on Dr. Michael Stone. And Dr. Stone, as you know, is the host of one of the greatest television shows ever, in my opinion, the host of Investigation Discovery's Most Evil. It's on every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And Dr. Stone is with us from New York tonight, as always. Dr. Stone, how are you tonight, sir?
Good, thank you.
Good. And I understand you went to a Broadway play tonight?
Yes, I was. I went to a Broadway play, and afterwards I got on the stage at the invitation of the fellow that did this play called Zombie, based on the life of Jeffrey Dahmer, and took questions from the audience about serial killers and such such topics. You know.
That, where was the play? Whereabouts
on 42nd
in the city?
Street.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what it was called, Zombie. It was about Dahmer, huh? Was it a highly stylized thing or?
It was, you know, written and acted by this fellow Bill Connington, who did a superb job of acting really according to a little novella written by Joyce Carol Oates some years ago about Jeffrey Dahmer, particularly about the fact that Dahmer used mannequins and objects like that, that inanimate objects, in other words, that he could have as kind of pretend lovers, because a mannequin or an inflatable, you know, rubber doll the shape of a person is a creature that can't reject you. So that was the motivation, you know, behind Dahmer's use of mannequins, and that was the focus of this play, which was enacted, you know, by this very skilled actor.
Oh, that's true. That sounds fascinating. You know, New York is great, and the theater there is great, but that's a whole other level. I gotta reach at some point, Dr. Stone. I know we were in communication with you, and we wanted to talk to you about something that I think has compelled this country immensely, and has a lot of people worried and a lot of people asking questions and suddenly going, now wait just a minute, what is this about? And that is the incidence of these very young people, young children, committing murder. Now, the first story in Arizona of the boy who killed his father and his father's roommate, that was last fall. This kid just pled guilty, as a matter of fact, recently. That child was 9 years of age. We now have the story of Jordan Brown, I believe is his name, killing his father's pregnant girlfriend. And the details of that case, which I don't know if you're entirely familiar, but apparently he did make an effort to hide the crime. He used a blanket, I think, to conceal the weapon.
Yes,
tried to conceal the shells.
Yeah.
The first question, and in your one of the emails that you sent to Jace, you mentions a term that I think is very interesting: psychopaths in embryo. And I don't know if that applies here, but I guess what you're saying is that they're already formed in the womb, this psychopathic nature that has no conscience, no connection to feeling. What do you think is going on? Let's start with this child, Jordan Brown, I guess we're more familiar with, who shot the pregnant girlfriend.
Of course, the motivation, and I think you can make a convincing story about that, was jealousy of the father's attention now being shifted to his pregnant, call her fiance or girlfriend, whatever she was. In other words, he'd been supposedly happy living with his dad. I guess it was, you know, divorced family or separated family. And all of a sudden, the father's, attentions are going to be shifted very dramatically, you know, to his fiance, the more so as she's about to have a cooking little rival in there, you know, who's going to come out and be a rival for this 11-year-old kid. And he couldn't endure that. And now, the real question in my mind is, the father gave him a shotgun for Christmas. Why did the father give him, 11-year-old, a shotgun for Christmas? That's a hell of a present.
That's a hell of a present. Yeah.
So, but that's another, you know, very strange element in it. And so, long story short, you know, he shot the poor woman to death. Now, what I meant by psychopath and embryo, in a way, I think what you said was correct. That there's a strong hereditary component to many cases of psychopathy. But what I meant in another context is that there's a certain number of adolescents who, embryo in quotation marks, they're like in the very beginning stages of becoming psychopaths. And these are kids that are called callous, unemotional. Callous, unemotional kids. I don't know whether Jordan Brown was a callous, unemotional kid or whether he was just too distraught, you know, but not necessarily callous. I simply don't know the facts about that. But there's a certain group of callous, unemotional kids who just treat other human beings like wooden objects and can do anything to them without remorse.
Let me ask you, Dr. Stone, about this young child, this Jordan Brown, though, because if he is not psychopathic, as we've come to know this state, that is one without any conscience or feeling, what is the difference between this child who is feeling jealous of daddy's new girlfriend and any other child that feels jealous of daddy's new girlfriend, that he would do this?
You have to talk about the intensity of feeling and something about his background, of which we know very little. In other words, mind you, there's many kids who have a sibling or a half-sibling born when they're already, you know, pretty used to being the only kid in the family. They're age 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And they don't go around killing their little siblings. They may feel like it, but they don't do it. So there's something about the braking mechanism in the brain that is obviously not operating at full tilt in this kid, so that the impulse, you know, to act out the jealous rage it goes the whole you know, full stop. It doesn't get interrupted. Now, why it doesn't get interrupted? There could be a number of reasons. And if the kid was, for example, neglected, maltreated, longed for his mother, and was cut off, you know, from contact with her. In other words, if his development was destabilized in some way that made him more vulnerable to go into action rather than just to think about how angry he is but not do anything. Those are things you'd look for, but I don't know enough about the, you know, the particular qualities of that home to know what it is that allowed this kid to go all the way and act out his feelings rather than stifle them or talk to somebody about it or whatever.
Or just throw a tantrum of some kind, or
now, you,
or run away from
gun,
home.
Having a gun with a youngster whose maturity is obviously can't be fully developed. He's only 10 or 11. It sets up the possibility for tragedy much more so than if the house is free of that kind of weaponry. So that's another.
You know, I have this really crazy idea, and I'm not saying that I believe this, but if I was a cop, maybe you would too. I'm thinking the father gave him a shotgun. I mean, is there some question of motivation on the part of the father in getting rid of a pregnant girlfriend by using a proxy?
Yeah, it would cross my mind. I think that's, you know, as a psychiatrist, I have to think about dark possibilities like that. I don't know anything about the father or his motivation, whether he was truly in love with this woman and hoped that absolutely they would marry and or anyway that she would have the child and he would cherish it, or whether he had profoundly mixed feelings about the woman or about the fact of incipient fatherhood, which is another strain on the person economically and emotionally and so on and so forth. But those are things I've certainly seen plenty of situations. You know, and Scott Peterson is really a case in point. I mean, he killed his own wife when Lacey was about to deliver. And the primary motivation, in my mind, is not that he wanted to be with that, you know, Mistress Amber, but rather because he couldn't endure being tied down for the so-called 20-year sentence of fatherhood.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Dr. Stone, and we are talking to talking with Dr. Michael Stone, the host of television's most evil program on Investigation Discovery. We are talking about young people, and you brought up a couple of cases that I got to hear you talk about. Because as we speak about young people killing, one other question, though, and Jason had this, and I think it's a good question. Had there not been a gun, just getting back to Jordan Brown for a second, had there not been a shotgun, would this child have attempted to kill this woman another way, or would that have pretty much ended that?
I don't think so, because mm-hmm. at 11, he could be overpowered even by a pregnant 26-year-old woman. In contrast to the Wendy Gardner and James Evans case, where Wendy, the 13-year-old, got her 15-year-old bully, you know, very tough guy lover, to yeah. strangle her grandmother. Now, the grandmother was in her 60s. She was more fragile. And the James Evans boy, this lover, was much stronger, and he could, choke the woman with a cord until she died. I can't picture an 11-year-old being able to strangle this woman. Or
yeah.
he might have attempted to stab her, but that could have, you know, backfired. So I think yeah. if the shotgun weren't there, I think that the poor woman would still be alive.
When we come back from the break, Dr. Stone, because you got us talking about children that kill, I want to get into a couple of cases here. One of them is this Jesse Pomeroy, who at the age of 12 you describe as a serial killer, 12-year-old yeah. serial killer, and Jürgen Bartsch, an right. adolescent serial torture killer in Germany. We'll be back. Dr. Michael Stone mm-hmm. with us tonight on Crime Night from Investigation Discovery's Most Evil. We'll be right back here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show.
Phil Henry. The world famous Phil Henry Show.
Back on Crime Night here tonight with Dr. Michael Stone. Don't forget our Twitter question having to do with President Obama and reversing that executive order. Should a doctor be compelled to perform an abortion or not? And with Dr. Michael Stone tonight on Crime Night, we were talking about the case of Jordan Brown and the other young boy, both arrested for murdering adults. In one case, the pregnant girlfriend of his father, the other, the father and a friend. And Dr. Stone, we're talking here about a couple of interesting cases. I wish you'd give us a little more insight into Jesse Pomeroy, who you describe as a 12-year-old serial killer at the age of 12, at an age where I guess most of the future serial killers are still torturing animals and setting fires, Jesse Pomeroy was out actively doing his thing, correct?
Yes, that's right. By the way,
go ahead.
Jesse Pomeroy goes way back to 18. He was born, I think, 1860, so
wow.
he's a very early serial killer.
Can I interrupt you and ask you this question? Because I think everybody wants should be clear on this. People seem to think we have more serial killers today because society is somehow coming apart at the seams. Is it not true that we seem to have more because the population base is larger? In other words, more people, more of this kind of personality. Is that right?
No, I don't think so, Phil. I think mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether society is coming apart more at the seams than people always think in their generation. But there has been, I think it's an absolute increase, even racial-wise, in serial killers, serial sexual, so what we call lust murderers, since the 1960s. There was always scattered incidents in the beginning around 1860, 1870, a few a year, but now there's been an outcropping, and in many countries around the world, we have the most, if you don't look at just the sheer population number, but rather how many per million people, even so America has the most, but there's plenty in Russia and France and England and Germany.
Yeah.
And it's mm-hmm. it has to do with something happening in the social scene in the last 50 years, but I'm not quite sure what it is.
Well, let's talk about 1860, and what country are we talking about with Jesse Pomeroy? United States?
Boston. It's the United States. He was born
wow.
in the Boston area, and he was born in very unfortunate circumstances. His father was very brutal, beat him for very minor things. His mother was also very sadistic. And on top of it, he had what they call a milk eye. One of, I think his right eye was kind of whitish and discolored in some way. So he also got mocked by the kids in school. And he was, now here was a callous, unemotional kid. This was a psychopath in embryo, if you will, who maybe he wouldn't have done such terrible things had he not been brutalized himself. But because he was, he really had it in, you know, for, you know, just whole mankind. And he went around and castrated little kids, boys and girls, a small number of them, before he got finally caught. So he was really vicious, you know, with knives and so on, and ultimately was put in prison, and he died in prison after probably being in prison for 50 years. But he really actually did sexual crimes on very little kids. And he himself was only a kid.
Oh, my God. But, again, are we not talking about some mechanism that he was born with or some fragility of the biochemistry there that eventually gets pushed over the edge?
I'm sure he was born with a predisposition. But if, as I say, supposing he was born with that callousness, that tendency to callousness, if he were born in a fairly nurturing family that was intact and, you know, not abusive, he might have been a petty thief. He might have been just a kind of a nasty kid, but he might not have been a murderer, let alone a sexual.
A murderer, yeah.
So I think there's an interaction there.
There's a difference between what they call nature and nurture. I guess that's what you guys call it there.
Things in both departments.
Yeah, yeah. Jürgen Bartsch, an adolescent serial torturer killer in Germany. What time span are we talking about here, Doctor?
Well, he was born in 1946. He was adopted. He was an illegitimate child in the, I guess, the western part of Germany. His mother died of TB, and so he ended up being cared for by this Bartsch family. And the they were very compulsive people, you know, cleanliness freaks. He wasn't allowed to play with other children in case they became dirty. His mother continued to bathe him all the time, and he... they would send him to a very strict school, and he began killing when he was 15. He was a really predominantly a gay killer, and he killed a number of boys and tortured them first, sexually abused them. He dismembered his four victims, and got caught, however, I think as he was trying to kill a fifth, and sentenced to life imprisonment, and he volunteered to undergo a, like a castration operation so that, perhaps he wouldn't do those kinds of things before. And he died on the table. Probably a small loss there. so that was the end of his story. But it was really, again, we don't know too much about the hereditary factors, but he was brutalized in the same way that Jesse Pomeroy was. And he became a sexual killer, very, very sadistic, and just more so even than Jeffrey Dahmer in a way, because Jeffrey Dahmer at least attempted to anesthetize, if you will, his victims by putting halcyon in the alcohol. They would get him drunk
in the alcohol,
a Mickey, basically, then he'd strangle him. Whereas this Jürgen Bartsch did the very torturous things. When
the torture.
Poor victims and were still conscious.
On your show, you often put at that highest level, 22 or 23, I forget what it is, those who torture.
Right.
You almost elevate that above the actual act of murder itself, because in your system, you see the torture, the aspect of torture to be the most depraved thing, correct?
Yes.
To kill somebody is one thing, to torture them before they die.
My 22 people.
There you go, yeah. Oh, and by the way, we got Tim Reiterman coming up later in the show. You put Jim Jones at 22, even though he never himself killed anybody. I mean, tell me about that.
I had trouble with that one. When I first read the book about him, I put him at a 12, you know, for sort of a power-hungry psychopath, you know, that got all these people down there and then ordered them to, you know, drink the cyanide. But I, the real facts of the case came out later, and when I interviewed this fellow, Tim Carver, who was one of the few, like two or three survivors of the Guyana episode, I learned a number of things which were not in the original book, namely that he would do terribly sadistic things to his flock even before, you know, the final murder.
The actual suicide. You know, Doc, we got to go.
In other words, imagine being in a group of 900 people. And
right.
And just being
Phil and go to talkradionetwork.com for more information.
Famous Phil Hendry show tonight. We're very happy to have with us Simon Botts. He's the author of a book entitled For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Jazz Age Chicago. Mr. Botts also holds a joint appointment as Associate Professor of History at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the Graduate Center, City University of New York. And he joins us tonight. Mr. Botts, how are you tonight? Thanks for joining us.
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me on your program this evening.
Simon, people here, I suspect that the names Leopold and Loeb may not be quite as iconic and archetypal as Babe Ruth, let's say, but I doubt that there are many people that you could say Leopold and Loeb to, and they wouldn't, well, that sort of rings a bell. Weren't they two guys that were sort of weird? And they were two guys that were sort of weird, weren't they, sir?
Yes, it's a famous case. It's two teenage boys, both coming from wealthy families, both extremely intelligent. Both were studying at the University of Chicago in 1924. And as you say, there was obviously something weird about them because one day they decided to commit the perfect crime, and that was to go out and kidnap a 14-year-old boy who was chosen at random. He happened to be walking down the street while they were driving past in a car, and they kidnapped this boy, immediately killed him. He turned out, in fact, to be a cousin of one of the two killers, of Richard Loeb. And after they had disposed of the body, they sent a ransom note to the parents of the boy called Bobby Franks. And the next morning, the Franks family received the letter, and it was the demand for $10,000. So that is certainly a very peculiar crime, and I think people recognize it because it was a random killing, because it was done for no real motive except to commit the perfect crime. And I think also what shocked people afterwards, after they were discovered, was that neither killer, neither Nathan Leopold, who was studying law at the University of Chicago, nor Richard Loeb, who was a history student, a graduate student at Chicago, neither one of the two ever said sorry or expressed any remorse. And so that was a particularly shocking crime. And I think that's why those are some of the elements that make people recognize that act by these two killers.
Simon, before we get into the actual crime, I suppose it's important to get to the mindset of these two men. We've learned more and more about what motivates killers. And as we learn more and more about what motivates killers, we realize that the motive for killing lies with the killer and not necessarily with the violent television that they watch, because Leopold and Loeb had no TV to watch. I suppose there was some film that they might have seen. But have we determined, have you determined, before we actually talk about this killing, what was the makeup psychologically of these two men? What were the backgrounds of these two men? Were they traumatized? Were they psychotic? Were they psychopaths?
I think the question which asks what were they actually like, when I was doing the research for my book, I was very fortunate in discovering the transcripts of psychiatric reports that were made on these two killers, which is a very unusual thing to discover. And inside those reports were clues as to the boy's behavior. And for example, with Nathan Leopold, he was the less outgoing of the two boys. He was very passive and quiet and studious. And in fact, it turned out that he had had a governess as a young child who had been intimate with him, sexually intimate, and that came into the psychiatric report. He had been bullied and teased as a very young child while at school. And he grew up with a particular fantasy to be the slave to a king. And that was his fantasy that the psychiatrist identified. With Richard Loeb, he also came from a wealthy family. He had a governess as well as a young child, and she had been very much the disciplinarian who had enforced her rules quite strictly. And his parents were both really absent from the household. They were doing other things. They weren't too concerned with the children. And Richard Loeb grew up to be the man, the boy, if you like, because he was 19 when he committed the crime. But he grew up with his fantasy to be the perfect criminal. He wanted to be the master criminal who would commit a crime that would be sensational, that no one would ever be able to unravel.
To uncover, yeah. So would you say that Loeb was the leader, was the ringleader? It sounds like he was the man who wanted to be in charge. He wanted to be the master criminal. Was he the ringleader? Was he the one whose idea this was?
Yes. In fact, in previous counts, and it's very difficult sometimes for readers to distinguish the two because their names sound kind of familiar. They both start with L. And so in my book, I referred to Nathan Leopold as Nathan, and I referred to Richard as Richard, just to distinguish the two between them. And it's very clear through my research that within this relationship, and perhaps what's unusual about this crime is that it involves this very close relationship, which is not too common within the history of American crime. But within this relationship, it was Richard Loeb who had the dominant upper hand. He was very outgoing, very gregarious, very sociable. He became friends with Nathan. Nathan did not have very many friends, and Nathan was very happy to have Richard as a friend. And so Nathan would tag along and do what Richard wanted him to do.
You know, it's funny, Simon, the similarities between these two men, I don't know how much they actually are alike, but Klebold and Harris had a similar relationship, Harris being the dominant psychopath and Klebold being the sort of depressive who went along with things, and I suppose that's the dynamic. Can you tell me about, so they're driving down this street, and were these two men, they were obviously familiar with each other, they knew each other, they were acquainted. Were these two men gay, by the way? This has always been sort of ancillary to the crime, but the discussion has always revolved around that. And,
yes,
of course, Alfred Hitchcock's movie Rope seemed to intimate that. Yeah?
Hitchcock's movie is the first thing that made me become interested in this case, and your question about their sexual identity is, of course, very key to this issue, that Richard, it appears, it's not 100% clear, or it's not completely unambiguous, but Richard was probably bisexual and did have girlfriends at the University of Chicago. Nathan was homosexual who had a relationship, who wanted to have a relationship with Richard. Nathan was very keen to have this relationship, Richard less so, and in fact the agreement between them, and this is in the documents, this is what I found in my research, is that the agreement was that Richard would agree to have sex with Nathan if Nathan accompanied Richard while he was doing his crimes, because of course it's no fun to do these crimes by yourself because nobody's there to applaud. So if Nathan would come along and say what a great job Richard had done, then Richard would indulge Nathan. So that's the rather peculiar relationship that the two of them had together.
Yeah, we're talking with Simon Botts. He's the author of For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Jazz Age Chicago. This is youth crime, although these two men were in college by this point, but it is the kind of crime that we're all too familiar with today. It shocked America in the 20s because nothing on this scale had been even really discussed before, although there certainly had been children who'd committed atrocious crimes, but these two guys were from prominent families, wealthy, and kidnapped this 14-year-old boy, Bobby Frank. So tell me, Simon, the crime. It was just random, as you say, but they had discussed, had they not, the idea of killing someone before this happened, right?
Yes, they planned it, in fact, for 6 months, starting in November 1923. They had done minor crimes before this. They had burglarized houses. They'd set outhouses on fire. They'd stolen various things. And certainly Richard had done petty crime from a very early age. And I think what happened was that they gradually became more and more used to the idea of these kinds of things. And then Richard, in November 1923, said to Nathan, "I want to commit the perfect crime." And they discussed it back and forth. They planned. They said, what's going to make this a sensational crime, a complex crime? And the element that they brought into it was to have a ransom, that even though they would kill the victim immediately, they would still demand a ransom from the parents, and the trick was now to get the ransom without being caught. And so, of course, this is another thing that makes this crime particularly noteworthy, because if you plan something for 6 months, then it's obviously not a crime of passion, it's not a crime of anger, it's not impulsive in any way.
So here is Richard Loeb, who not only wants to kill this kid but get a ransom because he's into his control thing as a possibly as a psychopath. So they spot this boy, Bobby Franks. What happens then?
So they see Bobby Franks walking down the street. They lure him into the car. As I said, Richard and Bobby were actually cousins. And they get into the Bobby gets into the car. They kill him almost immediately, club him on the back of the head, and then drive to a very isolated area south of Chicago, and they dispose of the body in a ditch later that evening. They take off the clothes.
Did they make any attempt? I'm sorry to interrupt you, Sam. Did they make any attempt to cover the body up once they threw it in this ditch?
No, in fact, they thought it was such an isolated place. The only thing they did was that, in fact, Nathan got into the ditch. He was wearing high boots on, and he put the body inside a drainage pipe. The problem was he didn't do it as well as he should have done, and there was a foot, just a foot, sticking out of the drainage pipe. And they had expected that this was such a remote place that the body would never be discovered, and they would get clean away.
I'm sorry to go back, but I just wanted to ask you one thing, Simon. You say they clubbed him on the back of the head. Was it just one or two bops on the head with some kind of an instrument, or did they really beat this kid? Was it just to affect the death, or were they sadistic about it?
I think it was really to – it was actually to knock the boy unconscious, because what they planned to do was to knock the boy unconscious. And then this is a rather gruesome detail. They planned to each pull on a rope tied around the boy's neck so that they would be jointly culpable of murder. In fact, because they lured the boy into the car in the middle of at 5 o'clock in the evening, and it was still light, and I think they began to panic. The boy wasn't unconscious, even though he was hit four times on the head with the blunt end of a chisel. And in fact, then Richard began to panic and pulled him back into the back seat of the car and asphyxiated him, strangled him, and he died pretty much straight away.
We're going to take a break. We're with Simon Botts, the author of For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Jazz Age Chicago. And really, it shocked the whole country. Two college students from wealthy families on their way to college degrees kidnap and murder a 14-year-old boy just for the thrill of it, literally, to see if they could commit the perfect crime. We'll be back with Simon Botts here on Crime Night on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
The world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Back with Simon Botts here on Crime Night, the author of For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Jazz Age Chicago. We talk about youth crime. This is the book to read. This is the case to study to really get at the matrix of the last 100 plus years of the criminal mentality among our young in this country. So, Simon, you were talking about how they had asphyxiated this boy, hit him, strangled him, killed him in the back of the car, or tried to, and then put him in this drainage ditch. And now what are they doing?
So they've taken off all his clothes. They have this idea. I mean, this shows you the extent of their planning on this crime, that in fact mm-hmm. they had brought along hydrochloric acid, industrial strength acid, because they thought that this would disfigure the boy's face and he wouldn't be recognizable even if the body was found. So they pour acid on the face, but the action of the water, in fact, prevents the acid from taking effect. And once they have left the body in a ditch, then they go home to their, to Nathan's home. They see Nathan's father. They say hi. They sit down and play cards. And eventually around 1 o'clock, they go. And Richard goes back to his house, which was a couple of blocks away, and that's the end of their evening. And then, of course, the next day, and there's a very callous attitude that both of them have, because the next day they go to classes at the University of Chicago. They're beginning to act as though nothing had happened and the murders happened, but it's not affected their lives in the slightest.
You know, it's funny, Simon. I was reading Dr. Robert Hare wrote Without Conscience, which is a book on psychopaths. He said that if you want to know the mindset of a psychopath, how do you feel when you carve a Christmas turkey? Well, that's how a psychopath feels when he is disfiguring and killing a human being. And this gives us an idea as to their conscience level, I suppose. How long, Simon, did things go on with these two guys just enjoyably moving about their lives before the police connected them to this crime?
In fact, it was a week, and the police had two clues, and one was the ransom note that the boys had sent to the family that arrived the day after Bobby Franks disappeared. That was the first clue. The second clue was a pair of eyeglasses that was found near Bobby's corpse. And at first the police thought that these eyeglasses belonged to Bobby, but then the family said, no, these aren't Bobby's eyeglasses at all. He didn't wear eyeglasses. And through that clue, the eyeglasses, they found out that they were a particular make, only three pairs that were made by a company in Brooklyn, and only three pairs have been sold in the Chicago area. And one of those pairs belonged to Nathan Leopold. And so once they realize that, and they don't know that Nathan has anything to do with the crime, they bring Nathan in for questioning him, and they ask, how is it that your eyeglasses or a pair of eyeglasses that are similar to ones you ordered, how were they by the corpse? And that's the beginning of the interrogation of Nathan, and it's on that clue that the whole case rests. And without that clue, it's probable that the case would have turned out very differently.
Meaning they would not have sold it, or they would not have solved it, do you think?
I think that's correct, because then once they have that clue, Nathan is forced to explain what he's doing on these particular days, and he then brings in Richard, because his alibi is that on the day of the kidnapping, on the day of the murder, he was with Richard in a car driving around Chicago and meeting various people, and that was the alibi. And so Richard and Nathan had created an alibi for each other. And the question was now, how would that alibi break? And the reason it broke is because they had claimed to be driving around Chicago in Nathan's red car, whereas in reality they had kidnapped Bobby Franks in a rental green car. And so while they were in police custody answering all the questions, the chauffeur for the Nathan Leopold's family says to the family, well, I can prove that Nathan had nothing to do with this because I was working on his garage that day. It was in the garage. And so when he goes and tells the state's attorney that the red car was in the garage, the state attorney realizes that the boy's alibi is not going to stand up and it's broken, and so he then confronts Nathan with the alibi as being broken, and that breaks the dam, and so then they begin to confess, and they implicate each other, and they begin to put the blame on each other's shoulders.
I can almost imagine Nathan being the guy that would crack. I'm sure Richard was. I wonder what that interrogation was like. And in the few minutes we have left, I just wanted to ask you this question, though. What was in the note, the ransom note that they sent to the Franks family? What was it, sadistic? Was it
was
manipulative?
It was simply to say, give us $10,000 and your boy will be returned unharmed. And that was the ransom note. And
really?
Yes, and so, and once the boys were caught, of course, they immediately confessed because they thought the police know everything, and then Clarence Darrow was brought into the case, of course, America's most famous lawyer, and Darrow took on the defense of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb.
And oh, boy, was, and that was just, was that before or after the Scopes trial? Do you
it
know?
Was, it was exactly 1 year before the Scopes trial, and it's those two trials, the Leopold and Loeb trial, and then second, the Scopes trial in 1925, that really made Clarence Darrow an international superstar, because...
Yeah, he was the Johnny Cochran or the F. Lee Bailey of his day, that is for absolute sure. Mr. Butts, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to reading your book. Our show... does a lot we do a lot of stories and interviews concerning not just crime, but why it happens. And we thank you so much for this book. It's called For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Jazz Age Chicago. Its author is Simon Butts, been our guest. And again, if you want to get a view into the succeeding decades of youth crime in this country, take a look at this book and the case that in the minds of many was the seminal case when it comes to kids that kill or young people that kill. Mr. Butts, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
You got it. You got it. This is Crime Night on the Phil Henry Show. Check us out online at philhenryshow.com for our daily video Philcasts and, of course, our unedited podcasts. Phil's unedited, uncensored podcasts are always, they're always a treat. We'll be back here. Remember our number, 877-876-PHIL.
Really in the name of
Phil Henry.